agenda. We have two items, one action, one information. Is there, are there objections or concerns about the agenda? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. Before us are the minutes of the March 13th, Customer Service and Operations. Are there any questions, and is there a motion? A motion moved by Ms. Porter, second. Second by Mr. Bulger. Any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor? And opposed. Today we have, as noted, two items on the agenda. The second item will be the information item on update on the customer outreach program that has been going on. And the first item that we'll take is the action item, which is the approval of the bus stop accessibility standards program. And so Mr. Kent is going to give us the presentation for that item. And this one will move us forward from our last committee meeting to an action of whether or not we shall adopt the standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Hudgens, and good morning, members of the board. We are back to talk about bus stop accessibility again. And first of all, want to just reiterate that. Is my mic made a little closer? Is this better? Okay. I did want to reiterate that. Following the last conversation that we had on this subject, we did put out a memorandum to you that kind of gave a little bit of detail, kind of explaining the distinctions between the efforts we've made with the grant to improve bus stops on one side versus the efforts that we are talking about now in prioritizing the improvement of stops that are directly related to those customers who have become eligible for Metro Access specifically because there was not an accessible stop in their vicinity. So we've kind of gone through that and given a treatment on exactly how that will be handled. But today's action is to pick up the point that the ADA standard for accessibility really describes the characteristics of the stop on its location itself. And what we're proposing is to add a fourth criterion to the standard that includes the accessible pathway all the way to the nearest intersection with curb cuts on opposite sides of the street. And by adding these features, it makes the stop much more functional and usable by the customer to really make use of the system beyond simply being able to board the vehicle at the point of the bus stop. So this is a very short presentation. And one of the things we said last time was that Metro, in adopting this amended standard, sets the example for the region on really what we mean by an accessible bus stop. And then it was our intention to go forward after that and urge the jurisdictions individually to do the same thing. Since the last time that we spoke on this, the good news is that both Montgomery County and the City of Alexandria have both confirmed that they've already done this, that they have a standard that conforms to this recommendation. So there's already been some progress on this item just, you know, within that short space of time. But obviously we want to make sure that that this is uniform across the region. So there is a brief presentation that just summarizes the issue again. The fact that the number of accessible or inaccessible stops in the region is quite large, and that really the intelligent strategy is to prioritize them and really begin making improvements on the ones that would have the greatest impact. And of course that also starts with defining the inaccessible bus stops with the standard that we're proposing today. So staff is recommending adoption of this standard by the board, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Kent. And I'll start with Ms. Porter and move to Mr. Downey.
Thank you very much. You talk about the curb cut, adding the curb cut thing. The assumption, obviously, is that there is a sidewalk that links the curb cut to the bus stop. Should we say that? I mean, I don't know. It may be, in Tacoma Park, for example, we have some blocks that have sidewalks on only part of the block. So, I mean, is that something we should say, or does everyone else assume that that's obviously the case?
I think that there'd be no harm in being clearer. We could certainly add that level of detail to this. The only issue, of course, is that the manner in which the improvement is made, some of the stops are being fixed while the sidewalks are being put in. And there are some situations where, you know, the environment is kind of a mix of some places where there are sidewalks and some where there are not. And really what we were emphasizing is once they get to the intersection, if there's a hard curb without a cut, that's really the barrier. You know, I don't know if we put the sidewalk piece in there, if we wind up having, you know, them being mutually exclusive. I don't know if that might in some cases detract from our ability to make a stop functional. So we held back from being quite that prescriptive.
Okay. And the other thing is I also wanted to thank you for the memo. That was very helpful information. Did this memo go to the jurisdictions also, or did you just send it to the board?
Yes, it did.
Okay. I know Montgomery County also has its list of inaccessible bus stops, but I do think, you know, there's a lot of value in coordination. Mm-hmm. And then the last question is, how long have we had the new Freedom Grant that we've been using to improve bus stops?
You can turn your mic on.
2009, it was awarded to be spent the following year.
So we've had it for 5 years? Okay, maybe
yes.
We need to get moving and do that work.
Yes, that's true. I mean, and, you know, part of really making that move has included this effort to prioritize. You know, with all the criteria that we've been discussing about the way to define the stop, I think we're at a place now where we're very clear as to what the work is that needs to be done, and that now we're starting to get more traction on it because we've answered those questions.
Okay, but it seems like 5 years we really sort of need to get it completed, right?
And if I could add, I think the priorities have pretty well been set. We're working with the jurisdictions. I believe many of the stops have already been identified, and contractors are in place and kind of waiting for winter to get over so that we could get working on it through the spring and the summer. So there should be a lot of activity over the next few number of months in making these improvements and trying to maximize the $800,000 that we have in the grant to get as much work done as possible.
Mr. Down.
Could you back up the slide? I have one question on each of the slides. Mm-hmm. When you say paratransit eligibility can be based on any inaccessible stop in the region, I don't think that means that until every stop in the region is accessible. You mean the one that person would normally use?
Well, what we were trying to say, I appreciate you citing that. What we were trying to say was it's not just the stops that are served by Metro.
Right. Yes.
That if it's within the Metro service area,
right.
Even if it's a jurisdiction.
But it's the one that the potential user...
It's the relevant one to the customer,
would use as part of the regular trip. So
yes,
if we get their stop fixed, we can say you are now capable, under some circumstances, maybe not all circumstances, to use regular transit.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Yes.
But there are other questions about where they're going, what's the weather conditions, and
well,
the
like. There also needs to be...
And the nature of their disability.
There needs to be a pathway from their home to the bus stop, and even if the bus stop is accessible, and even if that block is accessible, if they can't get to that block from their home, that's the other issue.
But we don't want the bus stop to be the last broken link in the chain.
No,
and then on the other slide, with respect to curb cuts, my recollection of ADA is that curb cuts are a requirement. So that when we say to the jurisdictions, you need to put in curb cuts, these are curb cuts that they need to do anyway. It's a matter of prioritizing which ones they do.
Do you want to respond to that? Sure.
And you're correct, Mr. Downey. What we're saying, though, in the case that was mentioned, there are some locations where if you're putting in a new sidewalk now, it is required by
work.
The ADA. But there are some locations that are current sidewalks that do not have curb cuts, and it's not in their grandfathered in because they were designed for
the... I also see lots of jurisdictions here and around the country putting in curb cuts as a general matter.
Correct.
I love it when I drag my bag behind me. That's all I had.
Any other questions? Yes, Mr. Bolger.
Thanks for the presentation. I guess one follow-on question is, if we prioritize these and get them fixed, will you all be able to give us a metric on how we were able to move people on the paratransit eligibility question over to fixed route? Is that statistically going to be available?
We will most certainly close the loop on, after we make those improvements, what the impact is. And one of the other things the board's also asked for that we're going to facilitate through the Accessibility Advisory Committee is an annual report to you on the progress on this item, so you'll get both.
Well, I'd be interested in at some point, whatever is appropriate, that we monetize it so that the next batch of bus stops that we prioritize, we can have data that shows the jurisdictions what the delta was between the paratransit costs versus the fixed route costs because they fixed the bus stop.
That's
notwithstanding the sidewalk question, and I understand that, Kathy, that's a big gap.
That's an excellent point, because that return on investment really is the inducement to make these improvements. And as we go and talk with the jurisdictions, that's going to be that's going to be a prominent part of what we talk about.
Yes. No other questions? With that, I'd just like to conclude that I think it's very important that we recognize that the 2009 time has been the time when we began that work with the jurisdictions. It's been a long, long haul, but it's when we went out and did that large inventory. We did all of that work to determine what is that we need, and each time along the way, we've been kind of nibbling at this. So what this does is, I guess, codify for the jurisdictions the criteria that we need in order to get past the barrier of moving folks from just metro access only to the larger fixed rail services. So I think this is great work that's done. I think everyone should see the benefit, and I think we all need to realize that we're doing lots of retrofitting, but we're doing a lot of new work, so everything would be in concert. Let me have a motion for approval.
So moved.
Ms. Porter, Mr. Downey, move to approve the motion. All of those in favor and opposed? Okay, thank you very much for your presentation, and thank you. The next item is from Ms. Bowersock, and Ms. Bowersock has been working on the expanded outreach and public outreach program, and she'll bring us up to date and give us the new information. Thank you, Ms. Bowersock.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and board members. So, by way of background, I'd like to just quickly review. In 2010, Metro had very little public outreach beyond the traditional public hearings that were developed for getting reaction to budget and fare proposals. And we did occasional surveys to gauge customer reaction. But that changed with the general manager's commitment to build two-way dialogue here at Metro so that our customers and management were constantly in conversation about the changes that were going on here. Thanks to Barbara Richardson's very early leadership in this program, we have today a very strong foundation of a research program through routine surveys and focus groups that are done, and a continuous pipeline of customer engagement here today. What we're moving towards, building on that foundation, through the creation of a full-fledged public participation plan that will come before the board for approval later this year, is an opportunity to reach more customers using more channels and more ways, and to really change the question that we've been asking from, what do you think about this idea or that idea that Metro has, to what can Metro do for you, and try to get their ideas about how service delivery would best make a difference in terms of their quality of life. So the questions are getting richer and deeper, and they're getting broader in terms of the communities that we're reaching as we go forward with this program. So let me talk first about the program as it exists today and the kind of tools and instruments that we use to gather public input. The Voice of the Customer Survey is one of the hallmarks of our program. It's a quarterly study of bus and rail passengers. During that period, we survey 770 of our riders. It's about a 17-minute phone survey. That varies between region when you look at other transit agencies and how long their surveys are. And that's in part a regional, geographic, and cultural decision about how long people will stay on the phone with you and how much they will tolerate in terms of questions before they disengage. And so ours is a 17-minute survey. Some transit preppers have a 22-minute survey. But that 17 minutes seems to be about the right amount of time that people stay with us. We do both landline phone survey as well as cell phone surveys. And that matters because if you want to reach younger folks, if you want to reach low-income households, typically the trend now is towards cell phones. And so that helps with our penetration levels and to get into communities where we often have a harder time reaching folks. In that survey, we also offer Spanish language folks to conduct the survey if we reach a Spanish preference household. And we are working towards a time when we could offer more languages through our phone survey vendor in order to be able to create more of that dialogue. Today, the written surveys online offer a range of languages, but the verbal surveys are somewhat more limited. What we ask people in that 17-minute phone survey is a set of questions about how they experienced the system in the last instance in which they rode. So we ask them about reliability, about frequency, about bus stops and cleanliness, and how they engaged with the bus driver, and whether or not they used the trip planning tools online or bus maps or bus schedules, that kind of thing. On the rail side, we ask them about their experience in our stations. We ask them how they found the rail cars. We ask them if they interacted with station managers. We ask them about their engagement, if they had any, with transit police officers. We ask them about fares, the fare machines, the use of their smart trip cards, their understanding of the fare mechanisms. And then, of course, we collect demographic information, which is to ensure that we have a representative sampling of the communities that ride with us in the region. Today, in our region, we have 26 languages spoken among our riders, and the demographic profile is very, very diverse, both in terms of race and ethnicity as well as in terms of income. And I'll talk more about that as we go through. The quarterly findings from these customer satisfaction surveys are reported to both bus, rail, and metro access operating groups so that they can have a quick turnaround of understanding what their customers are saying and where they're identifying any issues, if there are any, so that they can put management focus on addressing those issues. With respect to metro access, we do a twice-yearly survey, which tries to do some of the same thing, identify any issues that may exist with respect to the contract services that we provide. In each wave, we do 400 customers. They do an 8-minute phone survey, and we cover overall satisfaction with their trip, their last trip, the quality of service, the courteousness of the drivers, the comfort and cleanliness of the vehicles, and the service attributes such as making the reservation and whether or not they got to their destination on time, those kind of questions. We have, with our Metro Access customers, also refined our questioning. You may recall, we used to ask about overall satisfaction, and we found that folks have really long memories, and they would give you a cumulative total of their satisfaction in riding over the last 10 years instead of reflecting on their last trip. And while we care deeply about their overall satisfaction, for us to really identify issues as they trend, we need to know about that last trip. So we're capturing more information now with the Metro Access community. We also do a knowledge and usage survey on a quarterly basis, and that goes over how folks use the service, exactly what kind of destinations they're looking for. Are they going to the doctor? Are they going shopping? That kind of thing. Why they use Metro Access versus the regular route service. And that's important to us so that if we identify that training is necessary in order to give people or some outreach in order to give people access to the regular route service, that we can provide that. we make sure they understand and have familiarity with travel training program, with the free ride program, and with our e-alert system, and that they understand how to contact us, how to make a reservation, that kind of thing. We also brief the Metro Access staff management team on a regular basis on those findings so that they can address and work with the call center and the contractors on any issues that arise. With respect to other channels that we use to capture information, we have a mystery rider program. As you all may be aware, in the private sector, they're called mystery shoppers. So they're not unique to transit, but they're all similar in that we have folks who go out in plain clothes who you couldn't distinguish from an ordinary rider, who have a checklist, which they go through when they travel on the system, and they inspect for everything from cleanliness to courtesy. They give us those reports, and that helps us pinpoint and validate where issues may be happening before the customers even tell us about them. So it's sort of an early warning system, if you will. We also have qualitative research that we use to capture customer input through focus groups, principally. The qualitative research allows you to have a different kind of conversation. As you can appreciate, within focus groups, you get a much richer conversation about ideas and how people talk and think about and perceive the service. We use these when we need a variety of different kinds of feedback, including new fare payment system, fare gates. You may recall that we had a couple rounds of focus groups and had our Riders Advisory Council and our Accessibility Council come in and give us feedback on the gates that we were considering for the new fare payment program. We used focus groups extensively on the 7000 rail car design, and what's been rewarding about that process is seeing not only the ideas the customers came in with about how to improve rail car design, but having them come back when we introduced the first 7000 series car that came to the system recently to start testing, and seeing those customers say, that's the handhold idea I had, and that's the seat configuration that I suggested, and they feel a real sense of ownership, and they see the results, so they know that we're listening, and that we know that we're taking those ideas and implementing them. We also did extensive focus groups for Momentum, as you know, when we were doing the outreach around the strategic plan, and we really broadened that to say, we won't just do backroom focus groups where you watch through the mirror. We'll sort of blend the notion of a charrette and a focus groups and do open dialogues with communities so that we can have people in and facilitate a conversation and have more people engaged in trying to help us vision on the go forward. And that has been very helpful. We had about 133 individuals participate in those conversations, and that has helped shape some of our public participation plan thinking going forward. Other tactics that we're currently using to check the customer experience and make sure it's everything we intend. The call center that we have out in Hyattsville, Maryland, is processing numbers of calls, and we have metrics and productivity statistics about how those calls are handled. So we know how many seconds a customer has to wait before getting to an operator, and we know how many minutes they may be using the automatic system to navigate through. But what we also want to check is what their experience was when they were making that call to us, and were they satisfied with the response they got. So we have now a post-call survey. So you may be familiar, phone companies do this, cable companies do this. When you've finished your conversation because you've ordered something new or you've complained about an issue, you have the opportunity to take a survey at the end. We now do that randomly with our customers, and through that survey we can see what their experience is on the call. And that helps us refine and do quality control as well as productivity management at the call center. We also have a callback program. So we randomly select 100 customers a month who have phoned us with a complaint, a commendation, or a question. And we call them, call center management calls them and says, how was your experience? Did we satisfy the question you had or the complaint that you had? Since you called us, has anything else come up? Are there any other issues that we can help address for you? And we've been very pleased to see that in 99% of the cases, the customers are pleased to hear from us. They want us to be checking in with them. They like that two-way dialogue. In 1% of the case, maybe they only want to talk to us when they want to talk to us. But the other good news is that there is, on any given month, only 1 to 2% of customers whose original question needs to be redressed or another experience has prompted another issue for them that we need to follow up on. But that gives us an opportunity to do that. Of course, we have online surveys, and as the board knows, through all of our channels online today, through all of our digital channels, we are on a daily basis talking to more than 300,000 riders. It's a fairly sizable number when you add everybody together. So the online community really here has grown very dramatically in a very short period of time for Metro. And we see that also in terms of the participation level in our online surveys. For the fiscal year 15 budget and fare survey that we did earlier this year, 6,575 people responded to that survey. 43% self-identified as minorities. And we had 17% in that survey who volunteered that they live in a household with less than $35,000 of annual income, which is the basically the federal poverty threshold. That's the standard that we use. So that tells you that we're getting fairly good representation in the online survey, but I'll talk in a minute about what more we do to make sure that happens. That's the third highest survey response level that we've had in the past few years to our online work. The second highest was, of course, the Silver Line survey that we conducted last year with 7,729 people. And, of course, the station naming survey still holds the all-time record here at 16,200 respondents who wanted to weigh in on the station names for the Silver Line. So the participation is only growing. We also do here at Metro origin and destination studies. These are more in-depth surveys where we go out on the system and we will try to capture about a third of all bus routes each year, and now we've gone to a rolling system instead of an every 5-year system for doing this going forward. And basically, instead of trying to measure ridership or measure customer experience, we're measuring trips. It's really origin, destination. Where are people going? And that helps us in service planning, and it helps us determine jurisdictional apportionment of ridership. So that's a fairly comprehensive study that we do now a rolling basis. And then I would also just mention MindMixer, another tool that we implemented in our Metro Momentum vision process, which is an online sort of community ideas tool that brings people together to have thoughtful dialogue on a number of different topics. We also use that on the Silver Line map and on the fiscal year 15 budget. And basically, we ask 6 questions in each Mind Mixer round. The survey is online for about 6 to 8 weeks. And so for a town that has a lot of people who are very thoughtful for the planning community, for transit advocates, and so on, you get a really high level of thoughtful participation using that kind of tool, and it's very efficient. In terms of reporting back all of this research data, I will just mention that we do meet regularly, quarterly, with the executive leadership team on the data so that it's monitored and tracked and folks are understanding the feedback that we're getting. We also have, as a public reporting matter, Vital Signs, which now comes to you, is posted online, and where we track customer satisfaction index as a key performance indicator. And, of course, in between, we do have departmental reviews about special projects and feedback from focus groups and that kind of thing. With respect to the public participation plan that we're putting together, right now we have out a campaign called Speak Up, It's Your Ride. And essentially, we are trying to build a framework where we engage the public in a diverse way, using all kinds of tools to change the question, as I said before, to be more of an open conversation instead of just reacting one idea to the next. We're using all kinds of tools that are relatively new, including community-based organization outreach, as well as pop-ups, which we do in many locations around the system, bus stops and rail stations. And we've done them most recently at a DC United game, where we were there for the pregame. We did them in Shirlington, Virginia at a day laborer site and at the Montgomery County Tacoma Community College. So now we're expanding beyond just the system and trying to go to where there are large gatherings of people to have that same conversation, to pass out materials or to get them to take surveys on computer tablets. That assures that we're getting a variety of people to participate as well. I will say that we've learned in the time that we've been doing this, as we put our plan together, that people like free giveaways. And I say that because it's important. Our customers want us to get their opinion, but they also value their time. And so whether they're riding the system or they're attending a soccer game, they like the fact that we recognize that their time is valuable. And whether it's just a, you know, a little lanyard or something, a pen, it can be something very small. But that giveaway is very important to them, and they recognize it and they talk about it. We've also learned already, in terms of what we can do better and different for them, that they're really global in their view of transit and the way transit communicates. And by global, I mean they have seen in other transit systems communications that are available for people with limited literacy and with all kinds of languages being spoken. And they know that younger people aren't reading like they once did. So they're telling us that for young people, for non-English speaking people, for visitors from other countries, from visitors from other regions, we need to move to fare chart signage and brochures that use more graphics, illustrations, symbols, icons, and videos where possible, and stop using words. We use too many words. This is the Snapchat, Instagram generation. They're irrespective of age, and they want pictures. They want it to say like this in a picture, not take a lot of time to read it. So that kind of learning is so valuable for us in terms of the way that we're designing and planning communications and marketing going forward. And I'll just wrap up with a little bit of demographic information. With respect to the Voice of the Customer survey, our big survey that we do quarterly, I just wanted to give you a flavor of what we're seeing in terms of the level of responsiveness. So today, based on the first quarter of this calendar year, we had 48% folks self-identify as white or Caucasian, 34% black or African American, 9% Hispanic, 3% Asian, and the remainder were Pacific Islander, Native American, and other. Okay, so we are getting a range of participation, 18% low income, and we're generally seeing in our online phone surveys 18 to 22% low income participation. And in the Voice of the Customer survey, it's skewing slightly more female. D.C. is about 43% of the representation, 33% Maryland, and 24% Virginia. I want to also just address that in any particular tool or channel that we use, if we don't get the representation that we want, we're able to adjust for that to make sure that we're interpreting the data properly through weighting, which is to say that the once the survey's been complete and we understand the demographics, we use a formula that helps reconcile the participation with the demographics of the region so that our interpretation is weighted and could be seen through a lens that is representative. I also just wanted to say thank you to the community-based organizations that have been working with us in the public participation plan. And our EEO office has gotten tremendous participation from, this Services for the Aging in Washington, D.C., Hispanic Committee of Virginia in Falls Church, Montgomery County Refugee Training Center in Tacoma Park, Boat People SOS in Falls Church, Central Union Mission in Washington, D.C., and the Prince George's Community College Next Step Program in Largo. This will continue learning, and continue the learning that we're doing today is helping us to build the public participation plan that we're bringing to you. And going forward, we are happy to take your questions. I would like to just briefly introduce to the board Shannon Ballard. Just stand up, Shannon. Shannon is our research analyst, so if you have any questions about the formula that we use to weight or anything else that's highly statistical, I'm going to ask Shannon. Shannon has an MBA from the Kogod School of Business at my alma mater, American University, and she does a great job here at Metro, working with us on the analytics of the research and helping to translate the numbers into something that's useful for the operating groups. And thank you.
Welcome, Shannon. Thank you very much, Ms. Bowers. I've got questions. I'll start on this side and move around. Thank you, Mr. Costa.
Thanks so much for the comprehensive presentation. I'm glad to see that we're making investments in our research, because I think that's very important in terms of understanding our customers and our needs. I want to kind of focus back on the voice of the customer survey, and I know that we report out on how we're doing, but I want to get a better sense of how management is using that information to develop initiatives to improve customer satisfaction. And if you could give us some concrete examples of taking survey results and how you've translated them into some of these initiatives, I think that would be helpful for the public to understand that that what you're hearing is that we're taking action on what we're hearing from our customer base.
So I think that some of the results that we've heard through survey work and through other research, in particular customer satisfaction, is with respect to onboard communication. We have heard repeatedly from our customers that when they board a bus, they expect to be recognized. That could be a good morning, it could be a smile, but they want that level of recognition. The customer satisfaction survey measures that experience, and that's one of the specific areas that we look at, is the courtesy that they feel when they board the bus, the approachability, the knowledgeability of the driver, and the courtesy. So when we designed a new training program called the customer care program on the bus side, that was one of the major features of the training for our bus operators, was that moment, that opportunity you have to make a rider feel welcome and comfortable and safe boarding your bus, with that moment of acknowledgement, that moment of recognition. So it was included in the training. And now, in the go forward, in the customer satisfaction research that we're doing, we're tracking that to see, post-training, does it get better? That's one example. Would you like others, or does that answer the question? On the rail side, I'm sure Rob could speak to a number of these, but I'll just stay with the same theme. So one of the things that the customers tell us about their level of satisfaction is really driven by reliability and frequency of service, and their perception of how that functions. The issue that has also come forward, though, is about communication when they're on board and the service doesn't quite meet their expectations. And so when that happens, there's a very specific set of perceptions that people have about the way in which you should communicate with them about what the travel options are. We've basically taken that information that we've gotten through customer satisfaction and other research, and from the board and from the Riders Advisory Council, and we've incorporated that into the way that the Rail Control Center is focused during an incident. And it actually starts with Mr. Troop and works its way on down. While there is a conversation that's ongoing in a very urgent way about fixing the problem, moving trains, etc., one of the constant items that's focused on while managers are going through an incident is, what's the communication with the customer? What's the onboard announcement? What are we telling people? And we're checking on that every 5 minutes at this point, I would say, to make sure that whatever information we have that needs to be relayed to riders is out there through station announcements and through onboard operator announcements. And now in the customer satisfaction research, we track to see whether the communications perceptions are getting better as a result of that.
Thank you. I want to go around Mr. Downey and then Mr. Bolger and Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on Mr. Acosta's comment, which I completely agree with. I think it's extraordinarily good that we're reaching out, listening to the customers, so many different channels for doing that. I think we're well ahead. But what we also need to know is, what are they saying? And what are we doing about it? Now, I'm hopeful that as you modify and improve the vital signs report, we'll get a sense of that. And I know I've seen in a couple of occasions where particular items were being put before us with input that says, here's what we've heard and here's what we're doing about it. But the feedback loop is critical. We can't ask our customers what they want without getting back and saying, we heard you and here's what we've done. So I would encourage that for the future.
Mr. Bolger.
Thanks, Madam Chair. With all the research that you've been compiling, can you tell the board why our rail ridership is so weak?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
So weak.
I think that what we've seen isn't any different than what's been presented to you through the Finance and Administration Committee, that the SMART benefits differential, the federal subsidy for transit ridership, is an affordability issue for our customers, and it's affecting their ridership decisions. So even those who stay with you on a commuting basis may not be coming with you for discretionary travel on the affordability basis. The other issue is, frankly, that bus ridership is growing, and so we need to look at that too. Some people are particularly driven by some of our younger riders. There's a real appeal to bus ridership. Again, it's affordable, and it's a good service, and bus ridership at Metro is a great bargain by any transit standard. So I think there's also some choices being made to take bus.
A follow-on, Madam Chair. In your online surveys, origin and destination, do you ask our customers if they use the federal commute benefit?
On the last origin and destination survey, I'm not sure that question was posed. It was. Thank you. Shannon knows that question was posed. Mm-hmm.
Could the board get the results of that question? Just give it to me.
Sure.
For the rest of the board.
Be happy to do that.
Okay. Mr. Goldman and Ms. Hines and Porter.
Lynn, could you talk a little bit more about the Mystery Rider program? Are these people employees or contractors? How many of them are there? Do they ride from 6 a.m. till closing time? Just flesh out the program a little more, please.
Sure. So the Mystery Riders are... it's a contracted service. There's a professional firm that's here locally that has a contract with us to do the rides and produce the reports. The employees of that contractor tend to be part-time. Some are teachers who do this in the summer months. Others are people who have full-time jobs in retail and want to supplement their income. There was a gentleman featured in a recent Washington Post story who was a veteran, a retired military, who did this as income supplement. So the way it works is that the vendor contracts with people on a part-time basis to complete these trips and complete the reports. They aggregate the reports and deliver them to us on a periodic basis, and we review them.
And you have some metrics on how many hours are expended per week by the Mystery Riders and whether all lines are covered every day, just to get a sense of the scope?
Sure, and we could give you a fuller briefing on that. I'm trying to remember how they have a commitment to hit a certain number of bus routes every month, and they have to do every rail line. So we do really get a full picture of the system on a regular basis. I'm sorry, I just don't recall exactly what the number of bus routes is.
Madam Chair, could I request some kind of report that would be distributed on diligence from that kind of a
yes,
issue?
Yes, Mr. Goldman, I think it would be helpful
happy to get back to you on
describe
that.
The report so we all get a clarity mm-hmm. of how it operates. Okay.
I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing in terms of getting people's perceptions of how we're doing. You're right, in the last few years there's been an enormous increase, and I very much appreciate the work that has gone into that, and I hope that that means that we make better decisions because we have much better information on how people are reacting to things that we do. I think we're also getting there in terms of communication during incidents. I've noticed that train operators are, even for a short pause, are much more likely to give you something other than a rote explanation. You know, we're pausing here for 5 minutes, suddenly, you know, they have to actually explain what's going on, which I think is a help. But there are still situations where the operators are not giving, either giving no explanation or giving an explanation that's not an explanation. So we're not quite there yet. Now, fortunately, I haven't personally been involved in a major, you know, problem on the train. But I still am concerned that we may not be all the way there in terms of getting the information that people need. So while I really appreciate the progress that we're making, I just wanted to note that we don't have 100% observance by the operators of giving people information when the train is held up.
I think we recognize that, and we also recognize that the burden is not exclusively on the operator. I think there's a lot of them that are trying very, very hard to give good announcements and to keep their customers informed. It's also about having a control center response where the information is being developed and relayed to them. And we are teaming up with Mr. Troop's group to make sure that we're able to provide that information in as robust a way as possible, as quickly as we can, as timely as we can, so that operators have that real-time information to relay to customers, because we know that, that's what success looks like, and we still have a bit of a ways to go.
I was recently on, for an odd set of reasons, traveling midday, which I don't typically do, and it happened to be the day that we had the issue between Foggy Bottom and Roslyn, where the trains were for many hours single tracking, and I think I got on the first train very soon after the incident had happened, and people on the train were talking, and I checked my BlackBerry and I didn't have anything, so you know, I just said, well, you know, something's probably going on, we just need to be calm. And I want to commend you for later in the day, as we got closer to people leaving work, for putting out alternatives for folks who needed to come across the bridge, saying the 38B runs up Lee Highway or goes to Roslyn or whichever, and that people should consider taking the yellow line if they were heading south. And I think more of that, more giving people alternatives when we know it's going to impact the heavy part of the day. But earlier might have helped some of the daytime trippers who don't run it right in rush hour too. The question I wanted to ask, Lynn, is what's the definition of low income in your survey? Can you just tell us that?
Sure. So it's a household income level of less than $35,000, and there's a number of people that goes with that in the standard. I'm not remembering. Is it a household of four?
Has to be.
Thank you. It's a household of four or more people with less than $35,000 in annual income, and that's the using the federal standard.
Okay. I would like to suggest that you think about two categories here. We use in Arlington, and I don't know what the other jurisdictions, but it would be worth sort of asking everybody. People who are at 60% of area median income in Arlington qualify for a number of different kinds of supports. People at 35, particularly with a family of four, are really, they're the poorest of the poor. We need to understand what's happening for them. But I would say that for people at 60% and below, a lot about living in our region is very challenging, and transportation cost is a big piece of that. So we might want to look at to try tranches here rather than just the very poorest.
I couldn't agree more, and we do look at other income breaks for internal decision making. If the board would like us to report on other income breaks, we can certainly do that.
Again, I would say you might want to kind of do a jurisdictional scan and see if there's some spot that many of us are using as a place where potentially you qualify for additional help from the county or from nonprofits that the county partners with, or however it works. I just 35 is really low.
I'm sorry, did you say 35 is low?
$35,000 for a family of four is very low. That was my point.
I thought she used the word poverty, and I was about to say it was high, because it is high from the federal level. But if you're just using a number, I agree. I think it would be really good to set something and then deal with the poverty level as defined by the feds, and then what we think economically it means for us in the region. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the report. It's lots of progress. That's good in terms of the quality of information. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Two questions. One is, I know that you talked about the amount, the rate of surveys and the online survey responses. Do you have a differentiation between the respondents bus versus rail in terms of how deep the penetration is? Is it similar in terms of the quality and quantity of responses, or are we having to adjust for that? And I have a follow-on question.
We don't typically have to do too much weighting because we make such proactive efforts on the bus side to go out to bus stations and board buses with tablets and engage and get the level of participation that we want. If we didn't do that, we'd probably be relying on weighting more heavily,
okay,
because there would be some demographic distinction. But we have the level of participation on both that we're looking for to be representative at this point.
And then with respect to that, do we have a, in terms of the nature of the feedback that you get, whether it's on bus or rail, from different segments of the community, whether it be geographic or whether it be any other segments, do you see differences in whether it be income strata, how they feel about the service? And I'm thinking particularly, all of us have a choice. Some of us have more constrained choices. Do you see differences in how people feel about the service based on their ability to choose alternatives?
From the quantitative data, I can tell you that people in younger age categories are more critical than people in older age categories.
More critical
of the service. As an example, you do see some differences. You don't see those differences as much by income category. But it depends on the specific question. So I could do a check and see, you know, where the areas, where the top three areas where there is a dissonance between various income groups related to the service, if that would be
responsive. I think it would be helpful to understand but who's happier and who's less happy with the service, if there's meaningful information in terms of how we provide our service, the quality of our service, the service may be similar, but people may feel differently about it, and if so, why? I think it's important for us to get that dynamic of understanding, and undoubtedly those are factors that, from a management perspective, we pay attention to. But I think it would be information valuable for me as a board member to get some more analysis of that.
Sure. We haven't done that deep a dive by income. We do it more on an issue basis. So when we started to see a year ago that cleanliness of bus was coming up as an issue more, for example, we went to focus groups and we found out that the perception was based on what they were experiencing at the bus stop, not on board the bus. Mm-hmm. So we use that qualitative tool to get that kind of information, because for us, bus cleanliness perception is important to us irrespective of income level of rider. So that's where our focus has been, is trying to drill down on how, you know, when that quantitative tells you there's a trend, how do you address the trend? But if the question is, can we figure out, you know, if we have some customers, some riders who have sensitivities that aren't being experienced more broadly, we can drill down on that.
I think it's important. It may be sensitivities, it may be realities, but that would inform us about how we adjust our service. I think that it's, to the extent that we understand and observe that there are differences in perspectives of the service based on geography, based on income, based on any other meaningful factors that differentiate us, I think it's very important to understand those dynamics. And if it's simply sensitivity and perception, then how do we dispel the perception if there's no real difference? And if there is a difference, then how do we understand that difference and be able to adjust the service or the quality of service so that we have similar expectations across the board? Thank you, and thank you for a very good report.
Thank you, and we'll come back with some breakouts in the way that you've requested. I think that is interesting.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Ms. Bowersock, we want to thank you for a very good presentation. It carries the breadth of how we have, one, worked with our advisory groups, and now how we expand that work with a lot of research and analysis into the data. We have for our benefit the information you provided us about other transit stations that are doing some of the same, as well as the projects that are coming forward through 2014. So with that, no other discussions, then we are adjourned. Thank you very much.